As advertised yesterday, my plan is to just go through this judgment a little bit when the sign drops off the screen. It usually does after a minute. I want to go through this judgment a little bit because it's such a useful summary of what you're going to have to talk about in your seminar 5 on contract law and related things. Okay. Do go away and let us all read it. You had slides yesterday. If you've got those things with you, that'll be useful. We'll come to that in a bit. The important thing about PK Intermark Limited and Australian New Zealand Banking Group, the point we're trying to get out, is that even the most basic aspects of contract and contract law in complex financial transactions become really quite difficult. Very basic questions about whether or not there's even been an offer or whether that's been accepted can be quite difficult to figure out. It can be very difficult to figure out what the terms are. Now, this sociologically should be quite surprising. We've got very expensive and highly trained lawyers involved here dealing with enormous amounts of money. Nevertheless, the negotiation process will often drag on in such a fashion and be conducted in such a way that no one actually knows what's going on. So the judge here is Richard Sibbury, QC, sitting in the High Court, as the Deputy High Court Judge. Always vaguely suspicious when we read these kind of cases. This is described as an emerging markets investment product. That isn't a different product in itself. The differentiation between products are the kind of things that we've started to talk about. Yeah, ordinary loans, ordinary bank accounts, shares, bonds, derivatives. I mean, these are the divisions. There is no such thing as an emerging market investment product. That's what you will write across the top of something you are trying to sell to someone when you're trying to say, why don't you invest in Russia? It's an emerging market. You will make lots of profit. It is not in itself a separate term of art. The only difference it can make, and if it was supposed to make a difference, it should have been discussed in that way, I would suggest, is that if it's an emerging market, there is greater risk of loss, which is why, if it all goes well, you'll get a greater profit. The risk-return idea that we talked about much earlier in the course. So if that's what you want to draw out of being an emerging market product, then fine. But we must be able to see through all this stuff. We're not just going to get blinded by jargon, we're lawyers. We're going to try and work out what these words mean. And that's part of the product in this, part of the problem, I beg your pardon, in this case, is that no one really figured out what it was they were talking about. So in coming to this case, you've done conduct of business, okay, with a regulatory idea, not discussed in this case. Okay, the common law has been very slow to take this stuff on. What we do get some discussion about Mr. Pawani's level of expertise, he being the human being that's the controlling mind of PK, the claimant and customer in this case. Okay. So we're told that since 1996, he's been permanent resident in Dubai. All material times, he's a director of one of the controlling shareholders of PK, a company registered in the Isle of Man. So we're getting a sense of this being an Isle of Man entity. We generally register things in the Isle of Man for the tax regime. And we're told, paragraph 6, and this is the kind of thing you need to think about, you know, how would this reflect on the conduct of business stuff you're talking about in the seminars. He's considerable investment experience, clearly a man of substantial means. Does him being rich mean he's a good investor necessarily? He's described by an employee of ANZ, one of the client's witnesses, as being a sophisticated individual and an experienced trader. What we don't get is any sense that anyone's gone through all of the kind of client classification requirements that are now required under COBS. So one of the things about which you might ruminate is, you know, should contract law now be taking that sort of thing into account? Should we be requiring people to go through all of those hurdles and not just taking these sort of general blandishments about whether someone seems sophisticated or unsophisticated? I mean, that could just relate to his necktie. I'll zoom in slightly, sorry. Because this is one to read, all I want to do is kind of pick out things and explain what's going on. So we have ANZ, which is the bank, which is developing, the investment bank developing all these whizzy products we mentioned yesterday. They deal with Gringlay's Private Banking, which is a subsidiary. The business name used by the private banking business carried on all material times by various entities within the ANZ group. So GPB is one of the subsidiaries of ANZ. Okay, it's a posh private client bank being run in St. James's Square, but it's actually just a subsidiary of ANZ. So it's at 13 St. James's Square, London, S1, lovely. Mrs. Ranjita Banks of Romania is the regional manager. She's what I'll keep referring to as the account manager. She's the one in this private bank who deals directly with Mr. Pawani and thus with PK Limited. And that's important in a very complex group of companies, making up a banking group here. We have different people employed by different subsidiaries who just don't communicate with one another. Because as we said yesterday, what goes on is that ANZ starts to create, as discussed on paragraphs 11 through, or 15 and 16, different types of product to exploit these GKOs. Can anyone read out the Russian? I can't, it's not in Russian script, not in Croat script, obviously. But it's summarised as a GKO, Russian government bond. Okay. So this is a bond that the Russian government, as all governments do, issue into the marketplace. Look at the front page of the FT today. We in the UK, the government is issuing more bonds again, so-called quantitative easing, making more money available into the markets by releasing bonds and buying bonds back and those kind of things. This is how governments control the money supply. They sell bonds to banks when they want to soak money up, and when they want to release money, they buy their bonds back again. So there's all this kind of stuff going on with quantitative easing. That it's not literally Gordon Brown writing a check to everyone in the world and saying, here, have some cash, but it has the same effect. It's making money available to banks, the hope being that the banks will then lend it to their customers and businesses will thus start to borrow and be active. Why quantitative easing was thought not to be working when it started is the banks were taking all this very cheap money from the government and they were just using it to shore up their own capital. They were like squirrels at this time of year. They were just hiding nuts, basically. They were keeping all the money, hoarding it, and not lending it to anyone. So that's why they looked like it was backfiring. And that's the absolute heart of monetarist theory. If you want to know how monetarist economics works, that's it. Governments releasing money and sucking money back in. So this is speculating on these Russian government bonds, GKOs. I have a read of all this kind of stuff. They start off, the product was structured as a USD, US dollar deposit, to be made by depositing with ANZ, the performance of which was to be linked to the returns on a performance of a so-called reference obligation, namely a GKO, with a specified maturity date. What all that means is, very simply, you can't actually buy a GKO if you're an ordinary private individual. As I mentioned yesterday, Russian law is restricted to particular banks, or certainly was at the time. There are only particular banks who are entitled to buy these Russian government bonds. And therefore, the bank would have to buy them for you and hold them on trust for you as a customer if you actually wanted to have some property rights in them yourself. Russian law, comparatively recently, is absorbing the trust into its own national law. But, you know, wasn't particularly doing it that way at the time. So when this starts out in ANZ, ANZ is thinking, well, why don't we just take a deposit from our customers? Our customers will give us money. In fact, that's their gambling stake. And we will pay them back the return they would have got if they'd actually have been allowed to buy the Russian bonds themselves. So this is why this is called a derivative. You're not actually buying the bond. You're giving the bank money, and they will pay your return as though you had. This is how derivatives work. They're a virtual kind of investing. You don't have to buy the thing. You can just speculate as though you owned it. This is great if you want to speculate on things in Thailand or things in Russia. You don't have to have an office in Russia. You don't need government permission to buy and sell things in Russia. You can just sit in London, sit in your bedroom, and speculate, you know, as though you actually were in Russia, as though you're actually doing this. Yeah? This is kind of PlayStation 3 for bankers, basically. You don't have to be there with a gun, you can just pretend you are. Yeah. Anyway, you know what I mean. Well, maybe you don't. So that's how they started a deposit. And then someone had the wheeze, chapter 15, Mrs. Porteous, one of the senior traders from the senior sales team at ANZ. We should have an alternative version of this product structured as a note rather than as a deposit. The note would be issued by an A-plus rated issuer, meaning someone who is rated by one of the rating agencies as being A-plus. The best is AAA, so A-plus is a few clicks down that scale. I said to you yesterday, if you want very pucker clients, you'll try and organise AAA rated vehicles, but there's a limit on the things they can do, although we thought there was historically, before the credit crunch, and apparently any old garbage will get AAA. Historically, to be AAA, you had to be doing very safe business, you had to have plenty of capital to cover what you were doing. So if you wanted to deal with something a bit riskier, like Russian government debt, you would need an entity that was of a slightly lower credit rating. So that's what the A-plus signifies. It sounds very good if it's an SA, but it's not very good if it's a financial product, yes? AAA is much better. And then it would be tradable. So the point here is, let's have a note, yeah,
which is akin to a bond in the sense we've been discussing these things, whereby ANZ will go and buy these Russian government bonds. Remember, private individuals can't buy them directly. And ANZ will hold that bond on trust for the investor. Thus, the investor acquires, in English law, a proprietary right in that government bond, even if it's not owned directly under Russian law. Yeah? Now, that's enough, under the bond arrangements, as discussed in this case, to give you, if the Russian government fails to make its payments and fails to do what it's supposed to do under the bond, it gives you a right to participate with the other bondholders in directing ANZ. How do we get the Russian government to settle their obligations? So even if things go wrong, you've got a right to participate. The problem with the deposit idea is you've literally just made a gambling bet with ANZ. You've got absolutely no rights in relation to the Russian government bonds at all. So you're just sitting in London having a gamble. So the note looks like a much better product on that basis. Also a better product because they put in a US dollar hedge. Remember I said yesterday, part of this deal, if you buy this note, is that there's an investment there in US dollars as well as you acquiring a beneficial right in the note. And the expectation is, if something goes wrong with the Russian government, that'll depress the ruble. But people will probably then start investing their money from Russia in the USA instead. Usually a flight to quality is what bankers like to call that. You're running away from the scary, risky thing and everyone starts buying what they think is the safest thing. Typically, US dollars or US government debt. Okay? So that's why it's expected by the bankers, if you add in a small investment as well in US dollars, that's likely to increase by about the same amount, you hope, as the Russian investment will fall. So again, that's an added advantage in this note, because you've got some financial protection there. You also own US dollars, which you expect to increase in value, and you hope that will set off your risks. That's known as hedging in the marketplace. That's very different to Gardner's, but in financial market space, hedging, that's what you're doing. You're buying one product which you think will operate in an inverse direction to another product. So clearly there are huge advantages in this note. So that's what all this stuff is about. It's going through the detail of these products. The real problem here, at the end of paragraph 15, is that the FTCs, the final terms and conditions, are different from the original terms that have been sent out to Mr. Pawani. Which we'll look at those terms in a second. So while at the beginning he thinks he's investing in a note, and the account manager at the private bank thinks he's investing in a note, actually, the traders at ANZ internally have said, no, let's start sending the deposit instead. Let's do a deposit with these customers. Let's not sell them a note. But they hadn't told that to Mrs. B, who's the one who's actually talking to the customers. So the contract law problem there is, what's the offer that's actually being made to Mr. Pawan? At what stage has an offer been made? Now what happens is he is sent an indicative term sheet. And I have a copy of some of those terms somewhere here. Here's one I prepared yesterday, if I can find it. It's fun working in my end, isn't it?
Here's the indicative term sheet, okay? Now this is all set out, I've quoted these, all these bits, they're all in the judgment. I've just sort of pulled them out and put them on one page to give you an idea of what it would look like. It would be broadly a couple of pages with these kind of headings, this kind of scruffiness. It's headed a high yield note, notice the word note, linked to Russian GKO bonds hedged into USD. Yes. Good example there of the kind of jargon language that we have used in these things. High yield note, high yield suggesting that there is a large profit to be made on it. It pays a large rate of interest. Only, if we remember from yesterday, these bonds don't pay an interest rate. So what you're actually getting, if you remember yesterday, this is a Russian bond where the government issues its bond, but it requires you to pay much less for it than its face value. And so your profit is at the end when the Russian government pays you your money back, they have to pay you back the full face value. So you don't get any interest in the meantime. This is the slight bell and whistle here. You just get back a larger sum of money at the end. So that's your bet. Will the Russian government still be able to pay me back that full amount? Will it still be silent, effectively, at the end of the period? Linked to Russian GKO bonds, notice the linked to. In what way linked to? If you're a lawyer, you would think, well, what does linked to mean? What does high yield mean? What are you actually promising this customer? Is that explained or defined anywhere? Usually it's not, you see. Traders will use this kind of language all the time. And for a lawyer, it just raises the question, what on earth does that mean?
Yeah, a lot of lawyering, I would suggest, in trading floors is about asking the question, what? What and why? And please stop shouting at me. Hedged into USD, what does that mean? Again, we've talked about what a hedge means and how you would use US dollars, but again, there's no explanation as to how that's supposed to work. There's an explanation: the current six-month ruble yield on GKOs is close to 27%. Now, that is a good interest rate, as from the last auction when government last sold these bonds in Russia in November 97. If one could source a forward at a reasonable rate of about 8 to 10% with a reasonable bank, it would make US dollar yields of around 17%. In other words, we think you'll make a profit of 17%. This is the pitching. This is where you are basically marketing this to the customer. This is an indicative term sheet. So what the bank is trying to say is, we're not promising you this, but this is what we think you will make by way of a profit if you buy it. When we come on to talk about the law of misrepresentation and mistake and all these other kind of things, going to be after reading week, we need to start asking the question, is that an actionable misrepresentation? When we come on to look at tort a little bit later in the course as well, is that Hedley, Byrne and Hellerable? We'll look at the tort of deceit as well and think, you know, what if that's a deliberate falsehood in there? So all these things are making representations in a contract law sense and in a tort law sense. Let alone, what do these terms mean? So as a lawyer, you're always looking at this language and saying, what are we promising? What can we actually promise? You know, do we need a lot more language in here about, we think this is the position, you know, information available to us at this time, but are we actually making you firm promises? Is this an inducement? Do we actually want them to take independent advice before they buy? In which case, we need to specify that as well. There's a brief overview of risk. The investor takes the following event risks. This is literally what appeared word for word according to the judge on this indicative term sheet. Default, sovereign, in capitals, currency contract, tax-related, custodial and currency convertibility event risk associated with the GKOs. Grammatically, I don't think that really works. There's no definition there as to what's meant by default. What do you mean by default? Now, we've talked about default. We must mean that the risk there is that the Russian government will fail to make its payment on the bond at the end. But that's not being told to clients. So if you do this in the world, and you haven't classified your clients appropriately, do you know they'll understand what that risk is? So that's, if you like, as a bank, the risk you're running. So do we think that's enough of an explanation as to those risks? Probably for a market counterpart, another banker, yes. If it was the likes of you or I, or our grandmothers investing in this kind of stuff, almost undoubtedly no. So that's why COBS is important, because it kind of tells us in a contract law sense, I would suggest, how much explanation of risks and everything else we ought to be making. The principal could be, the principal, you know, instead of saying you the client, it says the principal, you're supposed to know what that means. In the university sense, the principal means something else. The principal could be at risk if the Russian government were to default. Could be at risk. If the Russian government defaults, of course you're at risk. You won't get paid. What's the could for? Undoubtedly will be. If the Russian government fails to make its payment, run screaming for the hills and gather your children as you go. That's what that should say. So a very euphemistic language. I mean, if a lawyer had got at this, surely you would have drafted this differently. Talking yesterday about traders entering these things into a computer and then an automatic contract being generated, one of the advantages of using that system in a bank, I would suggest, is that the lawyers can draft those standard terms in advance. And you just have to train your traders to know, if it's a client of this particular type, this is the form you use. So you just identify your clients as being an A client, a market counterparty, a B client, a kind of intermediate professional, a C client, retail, for God's sake, be careful. And you have different terms for each one. You just have to train your traders to pick the right ones. At Goldman, we had someone who had a legal background on every trading desk. Brilliant system, I thought, because they, by definition, understood all those distinctions. Tended not to make those kind of errors as a result, although other banks certainly did. And do, ANZ. Reference here to ANZ Private Banking. We've already seen that the actual name of ANZ Private Bank isn't ANZ Private Banking. So you've named what's supposed to be a legal person there. ANZ Private Banking makes no guarantee whatsoever. That's not even a legal person. So if you're the other side receiving this, you're going to think, well, who is this person? Actually, the bank through which Pawani was acting, if you recall, if I can turn over the page, is actually called Grindlay's Private Banking. So we haven't even called the bank by the right name, which is something that happens a lot in banks. So many subsidiaries, it's quite confusing for a trader acting in a hurry to know which entity is making promises and not making promises. And we get all this stuff. What are the terms and returns? Approx 3-month note linked to Russian GKO treasury bills. USD composite. What? You know, unless you understand what this stuff means in advance, how is this going to make sense? So conduct of business is all about saying, is this a market counterparty who would understand what these rates are, what the estimated USD yield, 16-17% per annum, actually means? Or if you're dealing with someone like Mr. Pawani, you need to ask, you know, is he going to understand what this stuff, how this stuff works, what it means? Does someone at least need to ring him and go through all this with him and make sure he's comfortable? If I was doing the lawyering, that's what I'd want someone to do. Especially if you're taking $250,000 off him, you think you'd check. Notice here, estimated USD yield of 16-17% per annum. This is basically saying we think you're going to make about 17% on this as a rate of interest, a rate of return. That's couched in very different language in amongst the terms and returns. This is how the judge sets all this out for us. Whereas at least up here, we kind of couch that slightly by saying if one could source a forward, blah, 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 if you could buy this in the market. The word if there, quite important. Down here, it's not qualified by an if. Possibly. And so again, you've got that problem of by this stage, are you promising this guy 16-17%? Or, if he's insufficiently expert, will he think reasonably that's what he's being promised? So again, a lawyer, you'd want to approach this stuff very differently. So this kind of scruffy stuff happens all the time. There is literally small print, we're told, in this. Please note terms are indicative. Now what happens is, Mr. Pawani reads this, is quite happy with this as a note, he's happy with the USD hedge and everything else. He doesn't read the final terms and conditions, which have changed this to a deposit. Now, if you were being hard-nosed about this, you might say, well, why does Mr. Pawani get any kind of remedy at all if he's the person who hasn't even read the final terms and conditions? Would you give away $250,000 of your own hard-earned money to someone not having read the contract? I hope the answer's no by now. If you've learned anything from a couple of years of studying law, surely that much, you read the thing. I mean, you know, signing up for mobile phone contracts and all that kind of stuff, when you know you're going to keep it for a month while you use up the free text and then move on to something else, fair enough. But this is $250,000. Yeah, $250,000 means very little to you, then can I borrow a fiver? You know, Mr. Pawani reads this document, doesn't read the final terms. Mrs. B, in the private client bank, doesn't read the final terms either. She opens the email. I always think this is slightly mad as well. But you know how many emails you get in a day? This is how this business has been done in banks these days. They email one another about $250,000. You just think, can we all just calm down? You know, how many of those emails are, you know, Amazon telling you your stuff has been dispatched? You know, people from countries you've never been to before offering you sexual favours and all that kind of stuff. And all that stuff is in your junk mail. You know, maybe it's just my emails publicly available. The junk mail is full of all this stuff I don't want to go into. And yet, why does Windows Vista download all my junk mail to my hard drive? I keep asking about it. Anyway, I get 200, 300 emails a day. It's ridiculous. So, it's just how we're doing business. She opens the email off, prints off the attachment, doesn't read it. Keeps talking to Mr. Pawani on the basis that someone would have told her if this was going to be different from the thing everyone was discussing originally. We might ask the question, how does she know whether or not anyone has actually told her if she's not reading the emails they're sending? But anyway, she continues to sell this product to Mr. Pawani. He doesn't read the contract either. They all go ahead with it. He hands over $250,000 US, and it's a different product by now. So the evidence becomes quite important. When you read the case closely, you will see. And so we get discussion in paragraph 20 and onwards about what Mrs. B understood this product to be and what it actually was in fact. Mr. Pawani's own evidence is contradictory. The judge isn't entirely convinced by him. But nevertheless, I think is swayed by the fact that Mrs. B herself says, quote, this has got wrong written all over it. Her evidence is that this is all a complete surprise to her when she's sitting in the witness box. We also get this from Mrs. Porteous, I beg your pardon, who's part of the sales team. When she first saw the contract note, this is paragraph 46 in the judgment, apparently in the course of these proceedings. If you're doing litigation, make sure everyone's read the stuff before they go into court, for heaven's sake. Because at least you're going to settle. If you go and talk to this woman who's in charge of the sales team, Mrs. Porteous, you say to her, did you know this is what they said? And she says, no, I've never read this before. You don't think we're going to lose. So let's just settle now with Mr. Poirley. Let's not have the embarrassment of going to court and then some smug academic telling a room full of 100 undergraduate students that ANZ behave like this, you know? Let's settle this out of court. But no. ANZ go to court quite a lot, actually. Most other central banks will just settle. They don't want to go near a courtroom because they don't want to lose, or they don't want their internal workings to be made public in this way. Reputation, of course, is huge in banks. No bank wants to be thought to be inept or about to lose $1 billion, you know, which is the irony of the last couple of years. Royal Bank of Scotland has posted losses of $2 billion in the last 3 months. Wouldn't it be better just to stay at home and no one go in? If you all stayed at home, wouldn't you lose less money? Yeah, maybe it's just me. Anyway, Mrs. Porteous, in the witness box, in the course of the proceedings there, she was mystified, shocked and perplexed all in one. She described it as a very sloppy operational effort and completely bizarre. Yes? But she didn't get a Christmas card from the chairman. Adding, it's got wrong written all over it. Of course, if it did literally have wrong written all over it, then presumably Mr. Poirley wouldn't have signed it. But anyway, or maybe he would, he didn't read it. And that it should never have gone out to the customer. Now, at that stage, regardless of whether you believe Mr. Poirley or not, once things have got to that pitch in the witness box, it should never have gone out to the customer. Once you've admitted that, you are hiding to nothing. The claim for misrepresentation is thus made out. Interestingly, at the very, very end, we're actually told by the judge, I'll find the final page, we're told by the judge that the parties may choose to bring a claim for contributory negligence if they want. Why haven't you been claiming contributory negligence anyway? I don't understand. Your claim would be, if you're ANZ, okay, we've done a bad thing, it's got wrong written all over it, apparently. Thank you, Mrs. Porteous. Come to the Christmas party. Christmas party that's being held underwater, you don't get scuba equipment. But surely you also argue, Mr. Poirley didn't read any of these documents, so he must be contributory negligent to some extent. Yeah? We've done spirit of negligence in common law too. Yeah? You agree you've driven your car into someone else, but it was their fault as well because they were drunk and they weren't looking either. Yeah, so they may be half responsible. That cuts in half the amount of damage you have to pay. I'm very surprised that they didn't automatically claim contributory negligence here anyway, and at least have 10% of the damages knocked off. Shouldn't Mr. Poirley at least have read this stuff? You know, we may have wrong written all over it, maybe we've done a bad thing, but surely you claim contributory negligence as well. So that's literally in the final paragraph there, paragraph 98. So paragraph 46 and on, we're explaining how this has all gone back and forth. Something that we thought was a note has become a deposit. So ANZ lose here. They're found to have made an actionable misrepresentation. Mr. Poirley, via PK Limited, invests $250,000. They get paid back $5,000, and the damages is the difference between those two sums, $244,000 and odd. Okay? Jolly good. So I suggest we have a look at that four-hour seminar. Okay? And I'll put all those slides as well up on Blackboard before we go. All right. What I want to do now, as advertised yesterday, is to try and take you quickly through master agreements. So kind of 20 minutes just to kind of introduce how all this works. So this is page 53. Apologies, I know some of you get really annoyed when I hop about, and I apologise.